I'm proud to be a Jew, but that's way too Jewish for me.
Shalom, and welcome to the Two Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guests this morning are stars of contemporary Jewish music, Josh Nelson and Neshama Karlbach. We'll also have a visit from our two Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our maven on Israel, Oshrat Barel. Please email your comments to us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit us on the web at twojewishradio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Two Jewish.
Shalom. Now that it's the month of November, we are approaching what in America is called the holiday season, that period from Thanksgiving through New Year's on our calendar. Well, this can be both a wonderful time of year and a challenging one. Just ask any mental health professional about how many people struggle with the holidays. This particular year, the season will be truly unique for Jews. The first night of the Festival of Lights, Hanukkah, is Wednesday, November 27th, just 3.5 weeks from now. That's the first time in 11 years that Hanukkah has actually started in November. And that means that the final night of Hanukkah is December 4th, the earliest in the month of December that anyone now living can recall it concluding. The reason that Jewish holidays move in relationship to the American calendar is that our Jewish calendar, the Hebrew calendar, is lunar, based on the cycles of the moon, while our secular American calendar is solar, based on the sun. Both are pretty regular, but with comparatively large variations from each other from year to year. The solar calendar requires an additional leap day every 4 years, of course. We call it February 29th. The Jewish Hebrew calendar is regular over a 19-year cycle that includes 7 leap years, in which we add an entire extra month. Over time, the two calendars get slightly out of kilter, and every 225 years or so, we lose a day from the Hebrew calendar to the solar calendar. So what does all that mean this month? Well, what makes this Hanukkah absolutely unique is that it begins the night before Thanksgiving. The last time this could have happened was back in the year 1861, the first year of the American Civil War, whose 150th anniversary we continue to celebrate. But Thanksgiving, now set by federal law as the fourth Thursday in November, wasn't even observed as a national American holiday until 1893, long after the Civil War. So in the year 1861, some states observed Thanksgiving November 28th, while others, including the mother state of Thanksgiving, Massachusetts, observed it November 21st, the third Thursday in November. So this will actually be the very first time we have really had Hanukkah begin the night before every American's Thanksgiving. Now, aside from some terrible attempts to create turkey-shaped menorahs and Stephen Colbert's faux complaints about Jews stealing Thanksgiving and making it into Thanksgivica, there's something actually pretty wonderful about this particular confluence of events. First of all, both holidays are based on the biblical Jewish festival of Sukkot, the original Thanksgiving observance, the Feast of Tabernacles. And all three celebrations, Sukkot, Hanukkah, and Thanksgiving, are dedicated to the expression of gratitude. First, some history. Sukkot is one of the oldest festivals, the harvest offering of gratitude for the sustenance that God gives us through the land and its capacity to produce bounty. In ancient times, this Feast of Booths was so important it was called Hechag, the holiday, as though it were the only one observed. Hanukkah, the historic holiday based on the victory of our ancestor Maccabees over the Syrian Greeks in the 2nd century BCE, was based on Sukkot, an 8-day festival of gratitude, and many of the prayers and rituals, such as the chanting of Hallel, passages of thanks, are based squarely on Sukkot observances. Finally, the Puritan fathers of New England, well-versed in scripture generally and fresh from studying Hebrew with a Sephardic rabbi in Leiden, Holland before they sailed for the New World, based their own harvest holiday on its biblical model, the Feast of Tabernacles, too. So, Hanukkah and Thanksgiving coming together is actually a reuniting that is totally appropriate and has been long in coming, no matter what, Stephen Colbert says. It's a kind of super Sukkot that we get to celebrate together. Turkey and latkes and candles and cranberries. Very cool. I must also add one weird pseudo-Hebrew oddity of this overabundance of festivals in this month of November. The Hebrew word for praising God in the Psalms is hodu, as in hodu l'Adonai ki tov ki le'olam chasdo, thank God, because God is good. The modern Hebrew word todah, thank you, comes from the same exact root. And the Hebrew word for turkey, the animal we all eat on Thanksgiving, is tarnagol hodu, or just hodu, which in Hebrew means fowl from India, similar to the word Hindu that hodu is derived from. That would be ironic enough, since it shows that we Jews had the same misconception Columbus had when he arrived in the New World, thinking he had found the Indies, the fast route to lucrative trade with India, which is why Native Americans were called Indians. In Hebrew, that etymology would make turkey literally Indian bird. But since the word hodu applies to turkey, and we eat turkey on the holiday of Thanksgiving, and the biblical word for Thanksgiving is hodu, and on Hanukkah we offer special prayers of Thanksgiving throughout the Festival of Lights, especially in the middle of the prayer modim, meaning gratitude, well, it's just a total overload of giving thanks to God at this time of year, on this particular year. Which is a very good thing, actually. We Jews have always been much better at criticizing than giving thanks, and maybe this perfect combination of Thanksgiving events and holidays will teach us a great lesson. We need to learn how to say thank you to all of the people in our lives whom we love and care about, and who help us to live and thrive. So, as you prepare for your combination holidays this year, only 24 more shopping days until Hanukkah now, and you really can't expect to get Hanukkah gifts this year at the after Christmas sales, now can you? Maybe at the after Halloween sales. Anyway, as you prepare for Hanukkah, take a few moments to offer a prayer or two for all that you have in your life, and those people who help you. And as you prepare for Hanukkah and Thanksgiving, don't forget to thank the source of all goodness, which is God. Well, we are giving thanks and are grateful to have not one, but two great musical guests here on Too Jewish this morning. To play us in, here's a favorite from one of our guests this morning, Josh Nelson. It's his rock and roll version of Yihiyu L'Ratzon. May the words of my mouth and the meditations of my heart be acceptable to you, God, my rock and my redeemer. Yihiyu L'Ratzon, Imefi. Vehegyon libi lefanecha Yihiyu l'ratzon imreifi imreifi Vehegyon libi lefanecha Adonai tsuri Adonai tsuri Adonai tzuri ve'goali Adonai tzuri Adonai tzuri Adonai tzuri ve'goali Please rise up to your feet right now. I don't That was one of our two musical guests this morning, the young Jewish rock sensation Josh Nelson, who'll be here shortly with a favorite guest of Two Jewish, Neshama Karlbach. Meet them both and hear about how they decided to make music together and what has transpired of that when we return here on Two Jewish. Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome the Two Jewish, two wonderful guests. One, an old friend, not that she's old, Neshama Karlbach, one of the leading lights in some of the most interesting aspects of contemporary Jewish music. The other, a not only rising star, big star in Jewish music now, Josh Nelson, one of the most popular performers nationally. Good morning and welcome.
Hi.
Hi, good morning.
So, you guys, I'm going to talk about working together first. We'll kind of do this backwards, if that's okay. Tell us how you started doing stuff together.
Neshama and I knew each other from sort of gigs that we played together on shared bills in the past. Jewish music is a pretty small world, but we had never really worked together in collaboration until last summer. I was producing a tribute record in memory of Debbie Friedman, and I called Neshama to see if she would sing, and we reconnected and decided to make some music together, and it all has sort of risen very quickly from there.
What do you like best about working together?
I think that Josh is one of the most fabulously talented people that I've ever known. He plays, I think, every instrument in the world. I'm sure I'm exaggerating. Someone that I wanted to work with for a really long time. And I feel like not only is the music just the most spectacular, just spiritually and meaningfully that I've ever had on stage, but I also feel that between Josh and I, we are really able to reach, I think, the core and the essence of the Jewish world today. Between my fan base and his fan base, and most importantly, with our intent to really reach out to the entire world, because we're not singing to entertain, we're not singing for the joy of it. We're singing because we believe that music will heal the world, and we begin with our Jewish world by bringing everyone together in one space to celebrate and to love, and then we plan to branch out into the entire world at large and to have sort of a partner in that for the first time in my career is really, it's an honor, it's a thrill. I've never respected another musician as much as I do Josh. So it's just incredible on all levels for me.
I have to confess, I was at the Reform Movement Biennial 2 years ago when President Obama was, I don't know, 2-3 hours late to speak to the group. He was the one everybody'd come to see, lined up for hours to see. And they said, hey, Josh, why don't you go out there and just entertain people for a while? That cannot be the easiest gig you've ever had, Josh.
It was a strange moment, a wonderful moment, but a strange moment. I was mostly just thrilled he was there. Just the energy that brought to the room for me was the real thing that I really remember about that day, honestly. But it was pretty wild. He was stuck in a meeting backstage with Ehud Barak and didn't come out. And it's a funny thing because I was up there, I was supposed to play a song before he came on, and so everyone else in the room was seated, and once everyone is seated, Secret Service doesn't allow them to stand up. And so because I was standing up, I was theoretically the only one allowed to go on stage. So I sort of got thrown to the wolves, but we had a lot of fun. We certainly had a lot of fun for a little while, and I thought that speech was brilliant that day.
It was a great speech, but I have to say, you carried that off. I was very impressed. We will talk much more with Josh Nelson and Neshama Karlbach about the music they do together, about reaching a generation of unconnected Jews and others when we come back on Two Jewish. Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke International, new sponsors here on Two Jewish. What is Freedom Smoke International?
Thank you, Rabbi Kohan. Freedom Smoke USA is an electronic cigarette company based right here out of Tucson. We were the first store in the United States, the first store to have all FDA-approved products. It's a healthier alternative to cigarette smoking.
No smoke, no tobacco, and doctors refer people to you.
That's correct. My doctor actually just gave me a glowing report from other patients he's had that I've been able to find this as a healthier alternative to smoking.
Cardiologists, pulmonologists, even dentists, huh?
That's correct. It does help with all that.
How many flavors can people get of this?
We have over 700 flavors available.
Where are the locations and how do people get connected?
Our first location is at River and Orange Grove. We opened one at Broadway and Swan, and we currently just had our grand opening at 12th and Valencia.
And we do have a store in Southern Michigan also.
And what phone number can people call?
You can call the toll-free number at 1-800-705-7013. That's freedomsmokeusa.com.
Thank you, and we'll talk some more next week. If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio@yahoo.com or visit our website at toojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through the website, twojewishradio.com, or download us from there at the Apple iTunes Store as very popular podcasts. One of my favorite compositions of the late Rabbi Shlomo Carlbach, Alav HaShalom, Zichrono Livracha, of blessed memory, was his setting of the mystical evening passage B'Shem Hashem, in the holy name, God of Israel. To my right, the angel Michael, to my left, the angel Gabriel, before me, the angel Uriel, behind me, the angel Raphael, and upon my head, the Shekhinah, the divine presence of God. This is Neshama Carlbach with Josh Nelson, and by the way, Hanan Elias, singing that song at the March of the Living outside of Auschwitz concentration camp back in April of this year. Na 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 Those were our guests this morning, Neshama Karlbach with Josh Nelson singing B'Shem Hashem, a melody of Shlomo Karlbach's. And now, a randomly recurring feature of Too Jewish are Zen Judaism moments, haikus for Jews. Today I am a man. Tomorrow I will return to the seventh grade. And a lovely nose ring. Excuse me while I put my head in the oven. That was our Zen Judaism segment, Two Haikus for Jews. We are delighted to welcome our Mivina on Israel, the head of the Weintraub Israel Center, Oshrat Bar-El. Boker Tov, Oshrat. Good morning.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you?
I'm well. So it was election day in Israel last week.
Yeah, last week was election day for
municipalities.
Yeah, for the municipal. And the theme for this election would be surprise, because it was in some localities in Israel, it was a big surprise, like Jerusalem.
Right near Barkat, the sort of technocrat mayor, the big successful entrepreneur who's done a lot, but is clearly secular, not Orthodox.
Yeah. I'm sure you know that he did a lot in order to, you know, to bridge the gap between the secular and the Orthodox. But it wasn't a big chances for it. That's the word you use?
It didn't look like he was going to win.
Yeah, and he did. Not with a big, you know, rate, but he did. And also in my hometown. But I want to share with you something about elections in general. My parents were very involved in, you know, the local politics and also in the national. My father was a member of a national Likud party. So election day is really a celebration of democracy in our house. So it's very special for me. So in my hometown in Beit She'an, it was a big, big surprise. The other candidate, like that compete, the current mayor for two terms,
the incumbent mayor.
Yeah, and he won, like, in the difference was only 100 voices.
100 votes.
Votes,
wow.
Yeah, only 100.
Very close election.
Yeah.
But he won.
He won.
And you know this guy very well.
Yeah, I know him very well. He was a close friend of my father, yeah, and he's a good one. Yeah, I wish him luck.
You know, when you think about Israel, we talk about Israel as a democracy, but that doesn't capture the spirit of the elections. I saw people were disappointed. Only about 35 to 40% of the electorate voted in a mayoral race. In America, that would be like a record high. In Israel, it's a record low.
Yeah. And actually, in some of the localities, like in my hometown, the rate is 80% going to vote. It's not the same like for the national election, but yeah, very, like, it shows the engagement, the involvement, the care of the people. Like
it's a very enthusiastic democracy.
Uh-huh.
Well, mazel tov to your father's friend who won, and deservedly so, and to Israel again for, you know, we don't say anything about Israel holding peaceable elections because Israeli elections are always peaceable elections. An interesting set of races. Thanks, Oshrat. We will talk next week.
Yeah, see you.
When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about Jewish identity both in America and abroad the last few weeks. And one of the findings in that Pew survey that made such a big splash, although to some of us it wasn't hugely shocking, I have to admit, those who are good, faithful listeners of Too Jewish know a lot of this already, was the idea that a fairly large percentage of American Jews, almost a shocking one, as you mentioned, 37% or something, think that it's okay to believe that Jesus is the Messiah and still be Jewish. That's a little bit of a different perspective, isn't it?
Right. Well, if you go back to the early years of Christian history, all of the founding fathers of Christianity,
all the patristic writers,
right, they were all Jewish. Many of them were rabbis and well versed in Jewish law. And for at least 300 to 400 years, Jews and Christians were really part of the same community, and they were either called Christian Jews or Jewish Christians or whatever, but they did not see themselves as being mutually exclusive or mutually antagonistic. What finally enforced a hard and fast difference, and what made the two groups see each other as mutually exclusive and even ultimately antagonistic, was a fourth century church council that tried to establish for once and for all that Jesus was God. And that was really the essence of the split. The question of his messiahship was probably less important because Jews didn't attach as much importance to the notion of the Messiah as Christians did at that point, or to the afterlife in general. Jews were less obsessed traditionally with heaven and hell than the early Christians were. But this question of the divinity of Jesus really marks a difference and has made it so that Jews and Christians historically lived in separate worlds. Now, of course, since the ghetto walls came tumbling down in Europe after the French Revolution and slowly during the course of the 19th century, there's been more and more social contact between Jews and non-Jews, more opportunity for Jews to assimilate or experiment with new forms of Judaism, or in fact to date and ultimately marry non-Jews. Nonetheless, 50 years ago, when our parents were dating...
Not our parents dating each other.
But... Right. Right.
Okay, just want to clarify that for the listeners here.
It was almost unthinkable in this country for Jews and non-Jews to date each other, never mind get married. Now, apparently, the percentage of people who marry outside the fold, as it were, is overall 60%. And if you take the Orthodox Jews out of that sample, it's more than 70%. So it's not only common, it's the rule, more than two-thirds. That is a shocking sea change in how Jews see themselves in this country, how they interact with others, and it is not a reflection of what it sometimes is in these tiny European communities where there's only 2,000 Jews left. There's not a shortage of potential Jewish partners. There's just a sort of nonchalance about whether you have to choose your partner from within the Jewish community or not.
You know, it says a number of things about Jewish identity that has been coming for a long time if you pay attention to the Jewish world. The real interesting questions will be what the organized Jewish world, I use that word organized loosely, does in response to some of these stimuli. Because one of the first things that happened was the National Federation Movement decided not to do a survey in 2010 because the results in 2000 were so distressing to them that they didn't want to hear it. I'm glad this Pew survey has come out. It's proven that the numbers weren't exactly right from 2010, but one of the things you've got to do is look at the reality and address the reality as it exists. Tom, thanks very much. We will talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor, your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service. One day, Rivka approaches her rabbi after services and says to him, "Rabbi, I have a problem. I have two female talking parrots I just bought, but they only know how to say one thing." "Oh," the rabbi asks, he's a bird fancier himself, "what do they say?" "They only know how to say, 'Hello, we're prostitutes. Want to have some fun?'" "Why, that's terrible," the rabbi says, "but I have a solution. Bring your female parrots over to my house tomorrow. I will put them in with my two male parrots, whom I've taught to pray, to daven, and read Hebrew. My parrots will teach your parrots to stop saying that terrible phrase, and your female parrots will learn how to daven. Thank you, Rabbi, Rivka replies. You're a lifesaver. The next day, Rivka brings her two female parrots to the rabbi's house. His two male parrots are on their perches in their cages, wearing their tiny parrot yarmulkes and their little parrot tallises, busily davening from little parrot sitters. Rivka puts her two female parrots in with the male parrots, and the female parrots say, "Hello, we're prostitutes. Want to have some fun?" One male parrot looks over at the other male parrot and exclaims, "Put away the sitter, Moshe. Our prayers have been answered." Oy, that was the old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humorist Bubby and Zadie knew, a special feature of Too Jewish just for you. You should live and be well. And now, a word of Torah. The urge to journey out into the unknown is a major motivation in Torah. We saw it with Abraham a few weeks ago. We find it in the lives of most of our ancestors. And we encounter it perhaps most powerfully in the story of this week's great portion of Vayetze. At the start of the tale, Jacob leaves his family and his home, both of which happen to be in Beersheba, and journeys towards Sumeria, perhaps today's Iraq or Turkey. He has nothing with him at all, not even a bedroll, and is forced to lay his head on a rock to sleep. In this state of extremis, God brings him a promise in the form of a famous dream. A ladder going up to heaven with angels ascending and descending, and a pledge of family and land and ultimate safety and security. It is a kind of stairway to heaven. Jacob, our forefather, wakes from the dream and says pointedly, "Hey, God was in this place, and I didn't know it." You know, that's something all of us can say from time to time. Somehow, Jacob must first leave everything familiar to allow him to find God's presence. Throughout human history, religions have been founded by individuals who left ordinary lives and places and wandered off into the wilderness, usually the desert. Abraham, Jacob, and Moses are the most obvious Jewish pioneers. Buddha, Jesus, and Muhammad fit the same pattern. In order to become who we seek to be spiritually, we must begin by leaving what we know already. Of course, when we finally encounter God in the wilderness, we learn that God was back there at home, too. We just weren't ready to notice that. Of all the heroic figures in our people's past, Jacob is the most interesting, I think. He's complicated, clever, unreliable, resourceful, and he has a rather spectacularly complicated love life, all of which takes off in this week's Torah portion of Vayetze. But it's that first moment when he realizes how little he really knows that makes him most human and most like us today. We, too, struggle to figure out just where we can find God. If we are lucky and aware, we, too, come to realize that God is in this place, indeed in every place. All we have to do is open our eyes and accept that fact. When we come back on Too Jewish, our guests, Josh Nelson and Neshama Karlbach, will explore the sources of their own contemporary Jewish music and how they believe it can heal the world. Find out just how that works when we return on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft, and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project.
Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Peace talks between the Israelis and the Palestinians are getting more complicated every day. Last week, after Israel completed its goodwill gesture by releasing 26 Palestinian prisoners it held for terrorism, many for many years, a second such prisoner release in the past 2 months, Palestinian Authority Fatah President Mahmoud Abbas welcomed 20 of them at his headquarters in Ramallah. He said to the crowd there, "We welcome our brothers, the heroes, coming from behind the bars to a world of freedom and liberty." "This is the second celebration," Abbas continued, "and in 2 months there will be a third and then a fourth until all prisoners will be released." The Palestinian president pledged he would not sign a peace agreement with Israel that does not include the release of all Palestinian prisoners. Thousands of Palestinians also gathered in northern Gaza near the Erez crossing, where the other four prisoners were released into Hamas-controlled Gaza. While cutting short the life sentences of the Palestinian prisoners has been particularly grating to many Israelis, prisoner releases were a Palestinian condition for reviving peace talks in August that few people on either side of the conflict believe will ultimately succeed. In all, 104 long-serving prisoners will be freed by the Israelis. The first group of 26 was let out 2 months ago, keeping with the understandings reached during John Kerry's shuttle diplomacy. Israel's High Court of Justice last week rejected a petition submitted by the families of terror victims against the release of these prisoners. The Almagor Group, which represents the relatives of terror victims and other bereaved families, routinely submits these petitions, and the Israeli Supreme Court routinely rejects them, ruling that the government has the power to authorize a ministerial committee to decide about prisoner releases and that such actions do not require legislation for approval. The release of terrorists in return for Tzipi Livni's dubious right to meet Saeb Erekat is very grave, said Habayit HaYehudi, a far-right member party of the government. In an apparent attempt to appease Habayit HaYehudi and other hardliners within the Likud aspects of the government, officials said new housing projects would be announced soon in West Bank settlement blocks that Israel will keep in any future peace deal. In other news, every time we think that garden variety anti-Semitism in America is disappearing, we get a story like this one. Just last week, a New York jury awarded a Jewish delivery man $900,000 in damages for the anti-Semitic harassment he endured at the restaurant where he worked. Adam Wersinski was subjected to highly offensive gestures, actions, and remarks made by his supervisors at the Manhattan eatery, Manja, one of the largest caterers in New York City. A night shift manager there would often joke about Zyklon B, the cyanide-based pesticide used in Nazi gas chambers during the Holocaust, and other supervisors would withhold Wersinski's tips, calling him a Jewish pederast and throwing pennies at him and calling him a dirty Jew. Wersinski worked at the West 57th Street restaurant from 1992 to 2008. He stayed there despite the abuse because he was worried he would not be able to find another job. He said, "Who else is going to hire a 50-year-old delivery man?" His lawyer said he was afraid. Three of the delivery man's co-workers upheld his allegations in court. The jurors ruled in Wersinski's favor after 3 days of testimony to the tune of nearly $1 million. In happier news, for the first time in history, two Israelis will meet on the court in an NBA regular season game. Omri Kaspi, the 6'9 forward for the Houston Rockets, now in his fourth year in the top basketball league in the world, has been joined by guard Gal Mekel of the Dallas Mavericks. Last Friday night, they met on the court. For a tiny country like Israel to have not one but two NBA players, both of whom actually log regular minutes for their teams, this is very cool. Perhaps you remember that old haiku for Jews. 7-foot Jews in the NBA slam dunking. My alarm clock rings. Well, the alarm clock is ringing, and two Jewish Israelis are playing NBA basketball right now. While Kaspi is only 6'9", and Mekel is just a point guard, the idea stands. 7 foot or no, they're in the NBA. Pretty darn cool. And that's the two Jewish news of Jews around the world. We welcome back our wonderful guest this morning. Josh Nelson is one of the most popular performers and producers in modern Jewish music. If you don't believe it, look at his website. But it is actually true. A multi-instrumentalist who plays pretty much everything really well and songwriter. His music has connected with all generations of Jews, but particularly younger Jews, in a way that almost nobody else has. Neshama Karlbach is, I think this is her third or fourth visit here on Two Jewish, a wonderful singer, songwriter, and conveyor of Jewish meaning through her music. She's the daughter of Rabbi Shlomo Karlbach of blessed memory, and she carries on his musical legacy as well as creating her own. Welcome back. So one of the most interesting aspects of contemporary Jewish music is it seems that many people think the way that you reach Jews today who are millennials or maybe slightly older than that, the first way you have to do it is through music. Now, you guys think you have to reach the whole world through music, but is this particularly true, and what do you think the keys are?
One of my favorite teachings is Heschel, that music is the voice of God. I quote it a lot, and it's really kind of a motto for me, I think. That, you know, this really is a universal language, and I don't think that it's necessarily an age-specific thing. I think music reaches everybody where they are, and it's a question of more so giving them the right music in the right place at the right time. And if you think about all those criteria, when you create and try to move, you know, this group of people, it doesn't happen so often for them, and it tends to be really effective and meaningful that the people are trying to meet them in their place, not just spiritually, but culturally.
Neshama, you've been doing this for a while now. Do you think that it's more effective with younger people, older people? What's the key?
I think that, people of all ages, of all places in life, are waiting to be touched, even if they were moved an hour before. People are waiting and longing for something that will make them feel. And I think that music has a way of doing that. And I feel very blessed that to have been the carrier of my father's legacy, that my father was just the voice of the soul. He had those songs that I still hear from people. My child was born, I was singing this song. My mother died, we sang this song. It's sort of the song of meaning that's in everyone's heart. And I think that everyone's just waiting. The world is waiting. And my father would talk all the time about bringing the voice of God to the world. And I think that when it's real, it'll touch the heart, no matter where they've come from or where they're going.
I think your dad had a song about the whole world is waiting for Shabbos. Is the whole world waiting for Jewish music?
I think the world's waiting for good music. And Jewish music has not, you know, always been, no offense to anyone out there, the best of everything. But I think Josh and I are ready to show the world what Jewish music is all about. We're ready for that.
I want to talk about your backgrounds as opposed to who you're reaching now. Josh, you came out of the conservative movement, I think, originally. Neshama, you know, an eclectically and deeply orthodox background to a degree. Does that affect the way that you speak and the way you think about Jewish music?
I think it speaks to the way we see the world. But also the fact that, you know, we've come from those places and we are in this place where we are now. It's a fluid Judaism. It's a fluid life, and it's in a constant state of change. And the way you see spirituality and halakha and living a Jewish life, like anything else, changes as you grow and as you change. So for sure, I think that we're both, you know, deeply influenced by the places where we grew up and the environments that shaped us. But we also are keenly aware and feel really fortunate to be aware of how that can shift in a way that, over time, as you develop and mature, that your sense of those things can also develop and mature. And to reach a place where you can have a musical partnership with someone who's been on a similar journey, yet a vastly different journey, makes the end product and the musical and the spiritual result really, really extraordinary and exciting for us in a really big way.
Let's talk a little bit about the musical influences in what you're doing together now? Obviously, you have your own creativity, the stuff you've been doing. What else comes into it?
I think everything comes into it. I think we're a product of this generation. You know, Motown, Debbie Friedman, Shlomo Barlaghoff, all kinds of amazing rock and roll influences. I think we come from a place where we have the same, to a certain degree, the same sensibility. But I think even more than that, I think it's just rooted in what we feel moves the crowd. I've never actually worked with someone who can sense that in the way that I can, that you just kind of feel, you can hear them almost audibly saying what they need to hear, what they need to feel. And sometimes that's a poignant ballad, sometimes that's something really loud, sometimes that's to jump around. And I feel like we, together, we're able to provide that in a way that, I know, it's kind of interesting. It's a new experience for me.
And the musical influences show up in really funny places. Working in the studio together, sometimes, you know, we'll have a similar thought about a part or what something should sound like, and we'll have a similar reference to a funny, nostalgic piece of music that we both remember from being a kid. Like, some, you know, anything from like a Zeppelin riff to some classical music, you know, motif. And that stuff really does show its face a lot. And, you know, I love very much that both of us have really wide bases of sort of music that we loved and grew up on, in lots, not just genre specific, but, you know, time specific, and really with really crazy variety. Sometimes we look through each other's iTunes library sometimes and laugh, because there's a lot in there that overlaps in really fun ways. So it's pretty wild to sort of hear what the music does when it's such a melting pot of influence.
I want to ask you a question about a word that a lot of American Jews don't really know, nusach. Nusach simply means, of course, the musical framework of Jewish prayer. If you grow up in a traditional environment, you kind of know how Erev Shabbat is going to sound, or Kabbalat Shabbat, or which parts of which services sound a certain way. Is there, I was thinking in your warehouse Shabbat, is there a desire to create sort of a contemporary Nusach or something along those lines where people kind of love, oh, that's how it goes for a particular service, or is it too dynamic for that?
Oh, no. I think Nusach is incredibly important. I reference it a lot. But the important thing to remember about that is that trope and the patterns and the modalities that we use in all these different services, and this tremendous beauty that the melodies do reflect different times and seasons, the truth is that that's a man-made creation.
You mean it didn't come to Moses from Sinai? It wasn't handed down with the Ten Commandments?
It did not come from Sinai. You know, there's an incredible book that's written by cantor Andy Bernard, where for what I think started as a graduate school project became a complete musically notated like codification of trope and of Nusach. And it's extraordinary. And there's so much to learn there, and it so is, you know.
It's very rich.
Feel that inflection in the songs that we write, because it is, for us, that musicality feels, even if it comes from man, it still feels like God, because the melodies we've associated with those moments for as long as we've been alive. So it's a beautiful thing to come from a synagogue environment where that exists. And not that you have to, you know, continually reference it in such an obvious way, but the fact that it is there in the back of our heads all the times when we sing and we pray, it really does, you know, influence the way that our melodies and our musicality comes to life.
I also think, just when it comes to Nusach, that I don't know, I feel like just as I would hear a certain melody in my head for a certain prayer, I think it's always important for us to remember that people around us, for whatever it's worth, they may have one moment on Yom Kippur, maybe they only pray once a year, but they'll remember it too. So it's not only about what we remember on the stage and what we want to bring forth, but it's sort of connecting through that moment of music, which again is the power of music, because you hear something little that you heard, you know, 20 years ago, whatever it is, and it transforms you, it catapults you into a different place of emotionality. And I think that prayer is so much about that. And I see that a lot with my father's music, especially, that, you know, these are, you know, you say Misinai, you know, people think that those songs were around forever, even before him. And people are like, really, your father wrote that? You know, it's like he's written so much. Bless him. And I'm so, so proud. But I see that when I start to sing an Esa Einai or, you know, Lamana Chai Barei, I see right. The way people act. It's like they just,
they go back. You know, some people come to me crying. I remember your father when I was 10 years old. He kissed me on the head. You know, it's, and that's almost a moment of prayer and of remembrance and of godliness that they take with them. And so I think it's all of it. I think it's, my father would say, we have to remember where we've been to know exactly where we're going. You have to hang on to above so you don't fall below. And I think that what this generation needs right now, Jewishly, is some of what we've had, some of where we are going, and everything about where we are right now in this moment, in this present time. And I think the nusach, the prayer, the performance, the musicality has to reflect all of that, or somehow you're missing what people need.
You know, it always seemed to me that that Shlomo Carlebach created his own nusach. Really, it was not the same, but it again spoke to something Josh said really quite beautifully. You know, it feels like it comes from God, even though human beings wrote it. Is that the highest accomplishment you guys can aspire to writing together?
You know, the truth is that it's such a constant game of balance. When you try to, when you try to channel something that's really deeply felt by you, it's really, I just think it's a challenge to keep it at all times as authentic as it can possibly be. And then not to let it get dirtied by outside influence or, you know, challenges, just to really try to be pure and honest about it on a very base level. And then if you can do that, then you're really accomplishing something and you're creating something that will resonate with other people because it's real. And that's kind of really what it is to be an artist, I think. And especially when you're doing it under this religious, spiritual umbrella, it becomes all the more important. It's one of the great things about working in a spiritual Jewish community as opposed to a popular music community. In a, you know, if you go to a popular music conference and everybody's in the green room, everybody sits in different corners and stares at each other and tries to sort of psych each other out. You know, and if you go to a Jewish music big festival, everyone's in the back and they're swapping stories and they're laughing and
telling
and
jokes.
Yeah, telling bad jokes.
Old bad jokes.
The real blessing of mixing the work, and you know this, I mean, to be a leader of a community, to be a teacher, is really, it's the biggest blessing there is, because you get to be true to yourself in an extraordinary way, and that privilege, and it is a privilege, does not get extended to everyone on an everyday basis, so you really got to be grateful and just feel very lucky.
Do you ever write something and say, wait a minute, that came from a Miley Cyrus song?
All the time. I've written tremendous songs by Chuck Berry. I wrote a great one by McCartney once.
Yeah, he was pretty good, by the way.
You know, right? Yeah.
If you're going to plagiarize somebody, you know.
There's a great Billy Joel story. I think it was on Storytellers where he's talking about, you know, he wrote this song and he brought it to the band and Liberty's like, that was great, man, and it's by the Kinks.
I want to thank Josh Nelson and Neshama Carlebach for a terrific visit here on Too Jewish. Listen for their music. It's everywhere, and it should be everywhere. And love to have you guys come back.
Anytime.
Thanks again.
Thanks. When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out here on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be Maestro James Conlon, the 2012 Kohan Foundation Award winner, whose classical music project, Recovered Voices, has revived and performed and recorded the music of Jewish composers killed by the Nazis. Our playout this morning comes from our pre-Hanukkah preview of music for the Great Festival of Lights. It's from the Jewish music sensation, the Yeshiva University a cappella group. They're all alumni now, but still, their breakout tune from just 3 years ago, their parody, Candlelight. My friends, have a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.
I'll tell a tell, yeah. Of Maccabees in Israel, L, 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 yeah. When the Greeks
tried to assail, sail, sail, sail. Yeah. But it was all to no avail, veil, veil, veil. Yeah, yeah. The war went on and on and on until the mighty Greeks were gone.